Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Leadership Enigma and another request. Please, please check out the YouTube channel. This is something now we're turning our attention to. There are over 300 videos on this. So many people now are tuning in and listening to us, but also watching us. Please subscribe to the channel so you know when the new episodes come out, and they are coming out regularly still. So, as you know, I love to specialize in the human being over the human doing. We talk to so many leaders from so many different iconic brands, a lot of Fortune and FTSE companies, the big, the iconic, and the global. But how about the innovative, the small, the agile, and the positively disruptive? So many CEOs that I speak to are worried about one word, and that word is irrelevance. How do they stop themselves and their organizations being irrelevant? What is the antidote to irrelevance? And you may have seen this little white can in so many of my episodes. This is a can of Cano water. Who on earth would come up with the idea of putting water in a can? Well, actually, my guest did. So we are going to find out about the entrepreneur, about the innovator, about the disruptor, and how this disruptor is causing mayhem now amongst the bigger brands across the world. It's a cracking story about the human being and the human doing, where I've got with me the wonderful Josh White, who is the CEO and co-founder of Cano Water. Trust me, you don't want to miss this episode. I'll see you just after this break. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to the Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts, and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Josh, it's a massive warm welcome to the Leadership Enigma. How are you?
I'm very good.
I'm just riffing there in relation to
it's a good intro. Good intro.
Because let's be honest, you and I have known each other now for a number of years. So it's a big thank you for coming on here. And I've known you and watched you through various stages of your life.
For sure.
From DJ now to CEO and co-founder of this little white can, which literally has appeared in hundreds and hundreds
of
episodes. I say this a lot. I got to go backwards to go forward, because you know that I'm always fascinated in the human being over what the human being did in order to create.
For sure.
And the incredible success now that you're having with Cano Water. So take me back to the earlier days of Josh White, before Josh White became the CEO and co-founder of this little thing right here.
For sure. So Josh was a very confused kid. Never really was conventional, yep. Always different. If someone went down that route, which is the more conventional route, from a very, very, very young age, I always went the opposite route. I didn't know why. I always felt very, very different.
Yep.
And that led to a lot of confusion and a lot of feeling lost, to be honest with you.
About what age did that start to happen, Josh?
Honestly, young. Like, we're probably thinking like 7, 8 years old.
Wow, okay.
And I think at an age where most kids aren't really thinking about or anxious, depressed, and thinking about what am I going to do later in life, I always felt like I had no purpose. I always felt less than. I always felt like I, as I mentioned, was different and had, you know, not a lot about me, to be honest with you. I was always confident on the outside, but on the inside, I was just completely broken. And from as far as I can remember,
yep.
School was horrible for me. I was never academic. I was always obsessed with music, culture, art, fashion.
The creative side of things.
Yeah, and 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that really, you could like those things, but it was never a route to go down, and never really an accepted
wasn't
route
a traditional
to go down.
Route,
it wasn't the traditional
was
route. I think, you know, my parents were always very supportive when it came to me being me, but I always felt, as I said, I always felt less than. I always felt like when looking around at my peers, I was always sort of like, what's wrong with me? And from that, became a lot of terrible self-esteem and always basically trying to be something that I wasn't. So just not accepting who I was, trying to basically come out of the Josh into, and basically putting on different masks.
Right.
So that came out of the form of basically at the beginning being the class clown, getting into a lot of trouble at school.
Being the joker in the pack.
You know, just I just wanted to be heard, basically. And because I wasn't academic, I kind of just, I wanted to just find a way for people to like me is the best way to describe it. And I was always quite popular at school.
Yeah.
Always had a lot of friends. But underneath me, going back home and spending the whole day trying to be that class clown and saying that I wasn't was draining. And
it's
coming
exhausting,
home.
Right?
Yeah. I was just unhappy. And it felt like there was this void that I needed to be filled. And, you know, from probably the age of 11, 12.
This is a lot of stuff going on at a very young age,
Josh. I was just very, very depressed, suicidal. I mean, at that age,
really?
Like,
at
why?
That age?
Yeah, yeah. And it's, I, you know, I never really talk about this, but I think that it is important because I've started, you know, there's a lot of kids that talk about this, but, you know, at 11, I was sort of self-harming myself.
Wow.
Which, honestly, for about 15 years post that, I never spoke to anyone about it because I was actually embarrassed. I was actually really embarrassed, especially as a man as well. Because like you hear a lot about that in women speak quite a lot about that, but you don't hear about it from men a lot. And that was something that I did in like year six, year seven.
And it was complete secret.
Well, my family knew because they saw it on my body. But it was just, all of these things were a cry for help. I just didn't know who I was. And do you know what? I hated myself. I didn't have any love for myself. To be honest with you, I probably didn't see a world beyond 18, 19, to be completely honest with you. And I was so worried about my future and so worried about where I was going to end up that I kind of just, every day was just, it felt like a year every day because I was so low. And I didn't really have anyone to speak to. Listen, my family knew, you know, I acted
very
out.
Tough on them
I acted out in all different ways. I started smoking at the age of like 11 years old. I, you know, started drinking, which, you know, is a very important part of my story. And I started seeing therapists and psychiatrists at a very young age. And at the age of 11 years old, I basically got told, you've got this thing called ADHD. And this
so
is
you
the.
You got that diagnosis.
I got that diagnosis.
Back then.
Yes.
Okay.
And this was at a time where if you had ADHD, you were basically a fuck up. That's the best way to describe it, you know? It wasn't an accepted thing at that time. It wasn't something that a lot of people spoke about. It kind of was like a. What's the word? Like it basically was treated as a. Like a throwaway. It was just sort of like, oh, he's got ADHD. He, you know. It's either people thought it didn't exist or people and people just thought it was an excuse or like you're kind of like, you know, you're put into different classes, you're put on rapport. And I felt like at this point, like less than I've ever felt.
Well, this is
going to
magnify that feeling of less than, isn't it?
100%. And like I got treated at this point
like
I essentially had, you know, essentially was had a really bad issue and a bad problem. And, you know, everyone knew now at this point, you know, because I was on report. I had to hand in my report card at the end of the class. And I had, I got longer exam time because I had ADHD. So it heightened all of it. And what came out of that was like a lot of anger, a lot of depression. And I kind of spiraled from the age of sort of like 11 to 15. I spiraled out of control. And what that looked like
was going to say, what does that look like?
That basically looked like terrible behavior, hanging around with the wrong people, finding people that also, you know, were bad, you know, and the, you know, at that point, you got, my head was telling me, you're bad. You need, you know, and I was going and finding other people who were.
Are you looking for answers at this stage? It's so difficult at this young. Are you looking for answers, or are you looking for stimulation, or are you looking to in some ways aggravate the situation more? What do you
so
know?
So stimulation's a really, really good, it's a really good word because that is a part of my journey. So I'm really glad that you've brought up.
We've lived through this in some ways.
Exactly. But stimulation and, you know, dopamine, this is the word of the century, isn't it? Dopamine is a really good word because there's different stimulants that, I would say back then I didn't know what my it's like a superhero not really knowing how to use his superpowers,
right?
You know, and he knows he could fly, but he's about to jump off the roof and he could die, or he learns very quickly how to use that superpower.
And you make bad decisions, don't you, at that tender age with that
exactly
as a motivator.
And I think, you know, all. When you feel less than, and when you feel like you're not as good as others, etc., and you don't see a future and you're depressed, you don't know how to use that superpower. So I just basically went down a path of hang around with bad people, getting in trouble with the law. I started drinking, which is a huge part of my journey because at a young age, nothing was going right for me. My grandma, who I love more than anything in the world, and was the only person that really believed in me and would sort of, when I got in trouble, would sort of take me in and always be my biggest supporter. She got ill. My mum got diagnosed with cancer. I was looking around at my peers and thinking, why is this happening to me? I was going through my GCSEs or, you know, just the year before GCSEs. And cut a long story short, when I drank for the first time, everything went, okay? So the depression went, the feeling less than went. I became more confident. I was able to be... Or what I thought the real me, I was like everyone else. And within 3 years, I went from being this kid that everyone wanted to be around, this lovable kid that people loved, but deep down, but I thought that no one did love me, to basically being the actual kid that no one wanted to be around, that no one actually wanted their kid to be around. I became a bad person within 2.5-3 years, and it's the brain is a strange thing. You know, you could have the best body in the world, and you know, the brain could tell you that you look terrible. You know, you could,
well, the dysmorphia,
the body dysmorphia experience. All of these things, and I suffer from that, and all of these things, the brain will tell me one thing, but the reality is another. And my brain was basically leading me down a terrible, terrible, terrible road that I thought was right, but also I didn't care because I didn't love myself. I hated myself. So really...
So that lack of self-care is a big piece, which I hear, by the way, from people a lot older.
Yeah, 100%. And that's like
still masking
imposter
it.
Syndrome. And all of these things, they're all linked. And I think that by the time I was 15, I was a full-blown alcoholic.
Right.
I was stolen a lot of money from my dad, I would do anything to get a fix.
You're feeding a habit.
Yeah. 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 I couldn't even, I had no empathy. You know, my dad is my rock. Like he is my superhero and I'm stealing money from him. My dad came from nothing. Okay. And he's built a phenomenal life for us. And I'm going and I'm stealing money from him to fund an alcohol and weed addiction. You know, I was very fortunate that at a young age, I found out that I had a cousin who died of heroin and I have another cousin who is clean off of heroin. And it was always instilled in me at a young age that of the effects of drugs and how, you know, we've got an addictive personality, an addictive nature within our family, which... Had I gone on for another year, I probably would have died from a drug addiction. But at this, I was so scared about touching hardcore drugs that I basically just drank my life away. And for from the age of 13 to 15,
I literally
2 years, every single day without fail, I would wake up in the morning, and you know, it's funny, this is ironic, I would fill up a bottle of Evian.
There is an irony there.
Exactly. Of literally pure vodka, wow. Pure vodka, 500ml bottle of Evian, two of them. And I would literally just take them to school and I would sip on it throughout the whole day. And I had to be, at all times, in order to function, I had to be a little bit drunk because I was so scared of being me that this was what I thought I'd found myself. I thought this was it. This is phenomenal. And it started as like feeling on top of the world. And on the weekends, I was so excited to go out and be this person. And I thought no one really knew. And the truth is, within 2 years, I was basically, yeah, I went from being this guy that could control it to being it was uncontrollable. And it took me to seriously dark places, you know, hang around with the wrong people, sleeping on like waking up in trolleys on the street, you know. Once I were but I didn't care. That was the problem. Yeah, because I hated myself. I was waking up in my local area, yep, on benches and going and walking just and not remembering,
you're
having
that
blackouts.
That no one wants to be around.
No one wanted to be around.
Almost
me.
The polar opposite, yeah, of what you crave.
Exactly. Exactly.
At what point did you get to where either you, because it has to happen inside you, you knew you had to do something about this, or you hit what some describe as rock bottom?
So I think that I knew that I had a problem,
yep,
but I didn't care because I wanted to die. I basically, my parents realized what was going on.
So difficult.
My dad realized that I'd stolen all the money. They basically said to me, you need to stop, you need to stop, you need to stop. And I remember very, very vividly that there were numerous times where I tried so hard to stop and I physically couldn't. I remember being 14 years old. I was sitting at a party and my parents were there and they were like, you're not allowed to drink tonight. And I just remember my whole body, and this is like the feeling of addiction, and this is what no one really understands unless you are an addict, because someone would just be like, just stop, just stop.
Yeah.
Your whole body goes into this, like, you need it. You need it. You physically, like, there's a voice in your head. You are, which is basically you, but you don't know that it's you, but it's you. And you basically, you're not stronger than that voice. The voice is stronger than you and you can't control that voice. And it's pushing you and pushing you and pushing you. And you basically just get to a point where you're like, I can't fucking do this. And you just erupt and you go. And I remember at that party, I erupted. I stole bottles and bottles of wine. And it doesn't matter what it was. I didn't care what it was.
It's not
anything.
Rational anymore, is it?
I needed to get back to what at that point was me. And as soon as I drink that drink, I'm back. And it's petrifying. It's petrifying. And I knew that the addict was controlling me. I mean, I was 13, 14 years old. I was smoking 20 to 40 cigarettes every single day. I hated myself. I hated what I looked like. I hated what I was doing, but I just didn't care because I didn't care about me. So at 15 years old, 16th of July, 2006, I've come home with my mates. They're all sleeping at my house, about eight of us.
Yeah.
And I'm paralytic, literally paralytic. I don't really remember too much of this. All I remember is basically my dad saying something about we're going somewhere. and I just ran off. And I fell over. I actually jumped over my next door neighbor. I jumped over my fence at my house and I fell over and I basically sort of smashed my leg on some scaffolding and was just pouring out with blood. I had this gash on my leg and my friends came and got me. They took me to my dad's car. All I remember is getting into the car, my dad sort of saying something like, oh, we're going on holiday. And my mind being, and I was so drunk, I just sort of went with it. Got in the car. The next morning I wake up and I'm in a treatment center, in rehab. In Kent, in the middle of nowhere, 15 years old, petrified, absolutely petrified. And also at this point, I think that I'm the big I am. I think that I'm a gangster at this age. Okay, I'm walking around like everyone's scared of me. I'm scared of myself. Okay, but I've got this mask on, and I've wanted everyone to look at me in this way. I want everyone to be scared of me. I want everyone to fear me. I want to be in control. And I'm sitting in this treatment center, bawling my eyes out like a little baby, and I'm in a horrendous way. And that
is this your rock bottom?
That for me was like, that's my birth. Right. that's the real birth. That's the day that I kind of look at as being the day that I became the person that people see me as today. Which, by the way, it didn't happen overnight. It took me years. But that is where I kind of look at it as like, that's the pinnacle moment of when I couldn't hide from the real Josh. You know, when you're sitting in front of like some very, very good therapists who basically are just telling you that everything you're saying is bullshit and you've basically got nowhere to run. You can't run. You're in somewhere that you can't get out of. And at 15 years old, this was the only treatment center in the whole of the country that would take on adolescents.
Or teenage
and,
addiction.
Yeah. And at this point, the adults could leave if they wanted to. I couldn't. I had 24-hour sort of like security or like...
A secure facility for you.
Yeah. And this was a rehab that homed, you know, some of... like the biggest celebrities who had addictions, all the way to the worst people in the whole of the country, the most dangerous people, people that, you know, essentially had the government were paying for them to be in there. The, you know, some of them who had 50-year prison sentences, but they got it cut short because they went into a rehab for 6 months. And I basically was in... this essentially the scariest place I've ever been in my life.
That's a pretty scary environment. For
it was petrifying.
How did you start to get to grips with this internal monster? Because this is, let's be honest, lots of people, regardless of age, suffer with a number of the things, whether it's depression, whether it's anxiety, whether it's imposter syndrome, whether it's addiction. And we know as well, don't we? And as parents, and I know you're a new parent too.
Correct.
You know, many of us have lived through watching our children struggle. It wasn't just because of the pandemic, but these are things which are, the more you talk to people, the more prevalent you find that they are.
Yeah.
How did you start to get to grips with that internal monster?
I think the most important thing is learning about yourself.
Go on.
Why am I doing this? Yeah. Where does this come from?
Yeah.
Okay. Who am I? Okay. And that starts from being yourself. Okay. So strip yourself back, get rid of the person that you're trying to be. And, you know, I had been in, I'd seen many therapists and had spoken to therapists for years, but none of them really understood me.
Right.
They understood mental health and they understood, but my thing is ADHD and addiction. Okay. And I needed people who really understood me. The great thing about the rehab that I went into, was every single member of staff there was an ex-addict. Okay.
So they really
I'm speaking to me. Okay. I'll tell you what the worst thing was, but also what opened my eyes. I wasn't in rehab for me. I was in rehab for my parents. Okay. My parents had a hold on me. You know, they gave me pocket money. They essentially, I lived in their house. I needed to do this for them. I planned to come out of rehab and drink, to be honest with you. I didn't think to myself, I'm never going to drink again. But what I stumbled upon, which I needed to stumble upon, is every person in that rehab who obviously was older than me, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s.
Doesn't care about age, right?
Age is irrelevant, which took me a long time, to be honest with you, to realise. But these people were fucked. They were in They were the they were in the worst place ever.
Did you see in some ways a mirror of what your life could be?
I saw very, very quickly that I would sit in the room in group therapy, which you do every day there, and I'd be hearing people talking. And however much I would try and turn off and not listen, because my ADHD is off the clock and I find it incredibly hard right. to concentrate, I would hear these people talking about me. Like, through them.
It's like the ghost of Christmas future,
isn't it? It literally was that. And it petrified me. And however...
Which is what you needed.
I needed that. However much I wanted to be, that's not me, that's not me. That was me. And it freaked me out, okay? And I basically, within 5 weeks, became inseparable with these people. These people were... They were... I mean, they looked... Everyone looked at me like their little kid... Okay, because I was 15-year-old little boy, and they basically, I learned so much there. I learned about me. I learned about where I could lead through them, but I also made real friends who understood me, and that was the most important thing. These people understand me. When I talk to my friends and when I talk to my family, they didn't understand why I was doing this. These people, they understand me. And that was really, really, really important. And, you know, the hardest thing of when I came out was, and this was at a time where there was no social media, I kind of had all of these people's numbers and I got in touch with them. And, you know, the most difficult thing is that most of them died and most of them wow. relapsed, you know? So I lost these people and I was one of the only people that actually survived, really. And that was something that was painful, really painful, because to see that, first of all, like, I'm not going to go into what I saw, but I saw the most horrible stuff that any kid should see at that age. Just stuff that scars me to this day and that always will scar me to this day.
Yeah.
But when I came out of there, I lost all those people, which was hard. But at the same time, as I said to you, I had gone into there for my parents and not for me. So I just came out with so much anger, so much. I'd lost a load of people. I just hated my life. I was like, why me? And I started to go to AA meetings and all these sort of different meetings. And I learned a lot about that. But I was so angry that I didn't care about that. And for 3 years, basically, from the age of sort of 15, 16 to 19 years old, I basically just carried on. I was sober, but I just carried on being this complete idiot. I was just angry. I just couldn't accept that this is my life forever. And yeah, basically fast forward.
You were sober,
but I was sober because I was scared of what I was going to lose. I was scared that I'd be kicked out of the house. I'd be scared that, you know, my friends wouldn't speak to me anymore because they were all very supportive and they wouldn't let me go anywhere near a drink and a drug. But I was so unhappy that, like, at this point, I wasn't drinking or drugging, but I actually, you know, I was going to basically commit suicide. That was like my plan. And that's where I was. That was my reality. And at 19 years old, I had a mental breakdown. I had a mental breakdown. And we'll talk about purpose, because purpose for me is the number one thing. I didn't know what I was doing. One thing that you mentioned at the beginning was DJing. DJing saved my entire life, okay?
That's how I first met you.
It's how you met me.
You were. Josh the DJ.
I am completely and utterly obsessed with music, okay? And when I came out of rehab, I basically got kicked out of school. I was still this angry person that was getting into trouble.
Yeah.
I was in trouble with the law. I was in court for something that I didn't do, but I was part of, and I was, you know, I could have gone to prison for it. And Carl Long's were short. My life was spiraling out of control, but I was teaching myself how to DJ. DJ basically got me out of a lot of trouble. I was so obsessed, and this is my ADHD around hyper-focusing, which comes into my superpower in the future in the story. But I basically just, I didn't want to be this person I was heading into, but I was so broken and I was so angry that why me, why me, why me? And I I basically relapsed at 19 years old. I basically had a serious addiction to laughing gas. And it started with one laughing gas, two laughing gases, five laughing gases, 100 laughing gases, thousands of laughing gases.
So you just switched laughing gas for...
Exactly. And I spiraled out of control. And in my head, I'm thinking to myself, this is how messed up my brain was. You're not drinking. You're not taking any Class A drugs.
So it's okay.
So it's okay. Yeah. And I have spiraled out of control. I couldn't even have a conversation without being on laughing gas. I was in such a bad way. And I just didn't know what to do. And I remember I broke down. And I remember just getting on my knees and just, you know, saying to myself, if there is anyone there, if there's any God, and I didn't believe in God, I never believed in God. I was like, if anyone is there, or if there's anything, please help me, please. And I was, as I said, like months away from, you know, I would have committed suicide. And I went to my parents. I said, I can't do this anymore. I ended up going back to rehab. And, you know, I'd say that was the birth of me then. Like, this was like my rebirth of, like, that was my rock bottom. That was the moment where I basically said to myself, I need to get my shit together. And, you know,
I have to start.
And I basically, I knew what I had to do. I had to go to my meetings more. I had to get more involved. I had to have a plan. I had to have a vision. I didn't have any purpose at all. And I basically just said to myself, I can't do this anymore. So I never knew what an entrepreneur was. I always worked, always, from the age of 13. Like, I worked in like a local deli. I never thought I was a good salesperson, but I always had something. Everyone used to say to me, oh, you've got the gift of the gab, you're this, and I just never believed in myself, you know, like imposter syndrome from the second I was born. Like, that's what it was. And I cut long story short, I came out of rehab. I started a business within music, basically an events company. And we created something special. You know, it was something that I loved. And the thing with me, I can't do something that I don't love. I would sit in an English or a maths class and I just would be drawing graffiti. I was always interested in art and graffiti. And I could not listen to one thing. If I'm reading a book, I could read 10 pages. And after 10 pages, I've only just realized at that point that I haven't taken anything in. Okay.
Start again.
But if I sit in an art class, or I'm listening to music, or I'm watching a movie, I am locked in.
Well, that's the hyperfocus.
Locked in,
isn't it?
And the hyperfocus, like, and I never knew what that was. I never understood it because, as I said, like, no one was talking about ADHD and it was bad and it was this. And, you know, we started this events company and it was my first taste of running a business. And even though we had no business acumen, we didn't know what we were doing. Like, we had no finance background. I had no idea. But we were just 19 years old and we were putting 5,000-6,000 people into venues. And we just were building a really cool brand that fed into the culture. It was to under 18s. It was called High Frequency. And we had some of the biggest sort of artists in the underground scene coming and performing, and it was phenomenal. And I never thought about, you know, at this point, I didn't even, throughout that year, I didn't even think about mental health. I thought I found my purpose, and I was like, wow. And this was the first thing ever that I was sort of like, okay, I'm getting somewhere here. And it was also the first time that I was me. I was actually me. I wasn't being anyone else. And, you know, that felt special. And
did that feel like a turning point?
It felt like a massive turning point. And within 1 year, my whole life, and I might get emotional here, my whole life just fucking flipped upside down. From coming out of the shit, going all the way to, you know, where I got to, this place of happiness. And I felt like at this point that someone somewhere was like, yeah, he's getting a bit too lucky here. We're just going to completely kick him down 100 flights of stairs. And basically my brother got diagnosed with cancer. And I won't cry. But it affects me because, you know, this was at a moment where I was my best, you know, and I'd just come out of a world of rubbish. He was 12 years old. And it was horrible. You know, it was dark. It was dark. You know, I was this complete and utter idiot. He is this innocent kid, and they've chosen him. And you know, this is, you know, this is where I was finally finding myself. And within that year, that happened to my brother. He was in Great Ormond Street for a year, living there. We had to stay there with him. My family had just were just broken. My whole family had just broken up. You know, my parents were never at home. Obviously, they were up there. We all took turns to stay there. I was trying to build this business. Under 18 events were basically getting completely scrutinized because of, you know, there was a lot of drugs and stuff that were happening, not our events, other events. So there was a lot of eyes on that. I suffered a severe breakup with a girl that I've been with for a long time. And literally, I spiraled out of control. And the business basically went under because they cancelled under 18 events. We were in severe debt because we owed a lot of venues and a lot of people. Right. And I basically just ended up in hospital. You know, I was in a horrendous way. And
on top of your family also dealing now with your brother.
Exactly. Exactly. Street. And I felt guilty to go to them, you know, and I was just in a horrendous way. And I ended up in hospital. I had a severe stomach issue, which they basically just turned around and said, you're dealing with severe stress and anxiety. And I just thought, there is no way that I'm ever going to be able to get out of this. I felt like the biggest failure of all time because we had a business that was, you know, within a year was putting hundreds of thousands of people in venues and we had to shut it down. And I basically just, I saw no way out and no purpose in life. But there's two things that I did see was I really enjoyed building this business and this brand. And when coming out of the failure, there was nothing like it. So I took a step back. I DJed. I was DJing all over the UK.
That's how most people knew you.
At some of the best clubs and venues and doing a lot of like private sort of stuff. And I started making a little bit of money. And I basically just said to myself, you know what? Everyone's out there doing what they're doing in property and recruitment and banking and finance or whatever it is. I am going to do what I love doing. And I basically, you know, from the age of sort of like 20 to like, 21, going, 20 to 21 for that year, I kept myself out of trouble. I basically tried to sort myself out, but still I was very, very low and I didn't know what my purpose was until I was 21 years old. And me and my two best friends, we went to Thailand.
This is in 2014, right?
No, yeah, this is it. Yeah, sorry, that's 2014. Yes, yeah. That is 2014. 2014, go to Thailand. I'm 21 years old and I went there for no reason other than just to go on a friend's holiday, basically. And we came across a load of plastic pollution. And listen, where we grew up, there isn't a lot of plastic pollution. You know, we are... I grew up in a nice area and, you know, plastic pollution wasn't part of my agenda. You know, I always tell people, I'm very honest, like I was part of the problem.
The issue of single-use plastics perhaps wasn't on your radar
no,
at this particular
not,
point.
Not on
life,
our
right?
radar. And it was something that we were part of the problem at the time. I probably was that kid that at 15 years old would go to McDonald's and chuck my shit out of the window. Like I was that bad. Okay. And we basically saw it and we were like, how on earth is this happening? Why is it happening? How do we change it?
Why do you think it had such a big impact on you at that point, 21, where you had all these challenges and suddenly this had resonated as a big... Why do you think that had happened?
I don't know, in all honesty. Okay. I don't know. But at this point in my life, I'd gone down so many lows that I kind of just was looking for my purpose and look like I needed to find things to jump on in the sense of like that were to help. Okay. I've always been the kid from a very young age that I would help everyone. Everyone would come to me for help, but I couldn't help myself. Okay. So I saw
There's
a problem.
Again,
yeah,
right.
Exactly. I saw a problem and it actually upset me, to be honest with you. And I don't know why I thought that it was my thing. And none of us thought about a business at this point. We just thought, how is this happening? Then when we came back, and this is an ADHD thing,
the hyper-focus.
We hyper-focused, but we just got obsessed. So ADHD and addiction are very, very, very close to each other, okay? And a lot of people with ADHD have addictive tendencies. And you mentioned a word before that's stimulant, okay? Now, if you don't know how to use those stimulants, the most easy way to get it is through having a drink or a drug.
It's through the negative.
Or smoking a cigarette or doing something that is either mind-altering or gives you that kind of high. So yeah. Nicotine, is a really good... It's a really good example of something that really mimics that thing. It's not mind altering, but it makes you feel a certain way. So we basically saw this statistic about how bad plastic was. And what we saw basically is that these environmentalists were going on about this for years, but no one was listening to them because everyone looked at them as being crazy. And through doing quite a lot of research, we saw that through all of the different packaging, glass is very heavy. It's got, a difficult carbon footprint because of its heaviness. You've got a Tetra Pak, which is like an Oatly carton, which is the worst because it's fused with different materials. And it's so difficult to recycle. And even though aluminium is a resource and it comes from the ground, first of all, we don't have to mine as much aluminium because it is so recyclable and it's always in circulation that 75% of all aluminium ever mined is just still... It's still in circulation. So this can that I've got on the table here, 60 days ago, this could have been a Red Bull. 100 years ago, it could have been a Heineken can or whatever it is. But it will always come back as another can. Whereas a plastic bottle rarely will ever come back as another plastic bottle. It shed loads of microplastics. And essentially, the reason it's so cheap is because it has no intrinsic value, whereas aluminium is a commodity, has a value. And we were just sitting there like, why has no one ever put water in a can before?
Was this your eureka moment?
Yeah. I don't think it felt like a eureka moment at that point, but I think that
does
like,
it now?
Yeah. Now it does.
That you sell millions.
Exactly.
And millions
like I think now it does. But the truth is that we were never looking at this. And I always, I always talk about, all these brands look at profit over planet. Like we just started from planet. We didn't care about, oh, we can make so much money with this. We were kind of like, it was a bit of a school project in a way.
Personal purpose again, doesn't it? That was the driving force. Before we go on to the story, let me just unpack a few things because this is close to my heart, all of this, right? What's kind of the biggest learning that you take from those chapters of enormous challenge, as you say, that almost ended your life, and you saw some things you can't unsee. Is there a real standout piece of learning that you? I know you're talking to young kids in schools now as well, and doing all kinds of things to help them. Is there a real single piece of learning that is just at the forefront of your mind all the time now in relation to what you went through and how you got through it?
Listen, it definitely made me more resilient. I think failure and feeling like a failure is good as long as you can pick yourself up. I think concentrating on yourself, so whether that be therapy, meditation, it could be finding a skill or a passion and all those things are just vital and key.
So you had to look after yourself before you had any chance of looking after someone else, right? 100%. You're now married, young child.
Exactly.
You've got to deal with yourself
100%.
First,
right? Oh, I couldn't be married and have no child if I didn't love myself. And that's, I think the main thing for me is... I needed to, one, find myself, which isn't easy, but two, I think that I needed to believe that I had it in me.
Yeah.
And I think that's the main thing. My whole, by the way, there's one word that is like at the top of the hierarchy of the reason I got to where I got to, and that's fear. Okay, I was scared of everything. I wanted everyone to be scared of me. I was scared of even waking up in the morning. I was scared of everything. Okay, when I was 16 years old, I entered into a talent contest and I fainted on stage. Okay, I was about to rap in front of 500 people. I thought I was Eminem, and I literally shit myself. I'm not literally, and I fainted literally on stage. from that led to me never ever being able to talk in front of like people like this, etc. I am a firm believer that if you can get, you know, I spoke about that voice in your head that we have. If you can be louder than that voice, and if you can get past that comfort zone and basically say to yourself, whatever comes to me, I'm going to just take, okay? And I'm going to rise beyond it. You can do things that you never thought that you could do. It's about how do you get over that? And I think that when I did get over that, and when I was like, you know what? By the time my brother got ill, I could be sober. You know, people in my family have had cancer so many times, testicular cancer, breast cancer, ovarian, you know, I've had multiple people in my life. And every single, when my grandma was ill and my mum was ill the first time, I wasn't sober. I had to beat the voice. I had to beat that voice in order to grow. And I believe that growth comes from, I'm a CEO now, I'm an entrepreneur. I would never have been able to do that now. I had to rise beyond that scared, fearful child. And as soon as I had learnt that I had to be louder, I never used to be able to sleep, okay? I had the voice in my head. I couldn't sleep. I'd be up all night, I had insomnia. It wasn't until I basically learnt how to shut that up that I could, you know, now I sleep like a baby. And that is a skill that I believe everyone can learn. But it's about taking the steps to get there, which I believe that every single person's journey is different.
Do you feel that you can now be the person you want to be to those who have loved you all the way through this and who have supported you, but actually were never the best people to fix anything?
Yeah.
Do you feel you're that person now? And so, you've got the strength to help them through some of their challenges?
Listen, some people you can't help, you know, it's just the reality. I think that, but I spend my life outside of Cannawater helping people. I spend my heart of my life, okay?
Why do you dedicate a lot to helping people who are struggling with this?
Say, would you say why?
No, I know you do.
Oh, yeah,
but,
yeah.
And listen, you know, you and I have chatted before and you have helped someone very dear and close to me, and I will be forever grateful. Mm. But it also showed me just the size of the issue, and this is not an age-specific issue.
No.
We're talking about now the youngest to the oldest and everything in between.
Yeah.
For many people, it is masked,
yeah,
and it is a living nightmare for a number of people who can still be high-functioning,
yeah,
but there are some deep-rooted issues.
Yeah, below, I mean, I'm dealing with these things every day.
Yeah,
you know, I have a family member who's currently a very close family member who's in rehab at the moment. Who, you know, is, you know, it's painful. And I've got other family members who deal with addiction and mental health disorders, and some people you just can't help. I think where my head is and what I've always been very passionate about is I will do anything in my power to try, always. And like, I've got a gift, okay, of giving now, okay? And I believe that, and maybe this is just me, what's the point of being on this planet if you can't pass to others what you've learned, you know? And I think that it's incredibly important, you know? Talk about leadership. You know, that is a perfect
example.
Well, that's
the first time we've used that word, and I make absolutely no apologies that we spent a long time talking about the human being, because this whole podcast has always been about the human being over the human doing.
Yeah,
and we've talked about what you described as superpowers of actually your addiction,
yeah,
the ADHD, the hyperfocus, your finding of a personal purpose, which all led to you being what a lot of people thought was the crazy person.
Yeah.
Launching the world's first canned water.
Yes.
And it was in 2015, yeah. This was the first canned water
in the world. Yes.
And let's be honest, people thought you were nuts.
Crazy. Even my own family.
I know.
Absolutely mad. And I think that's, you know, in this country, there isn't a lot of risk taking. Okay. So there's a reason.
Fear.
Fear. There's a reason, and let's come back to that, because that's actually what you've said here. I had already overcome my fear, so I'm a risk taker already, and I think that at this point, when starting Cannawater, I felt like I couldn't go backwards. I've already been to the darkest place of my life, so risk, and also I was DJing, and I felt like a bit of a. You know, like...
Do you feel like you've got nothing to lose?
Yeah, I kind of felt like that.
Right.
But I sort of felt like I felt confident that I only wanted to do the things that I want to do and no one's going to tell me not to. But in this country, there's a reason why there's no Airbnb founders or Uber founders, or because the reality is we are all scared of risk and it needs a few crazy people to sort of be like, you know what? I'm going to be the person to do it. And I think that, you know, when we first sort of came up with the idea of putting water in a can, we went to so many people that we respected and so many people that we were like, oh, we're so excited to go and see them.
What was their reaction?
They just, people thought we were crazy. Absolutely mental. I mean, I came home once and my sister was saying to her friend, like, oh, we heard about Josh, he's putting water in a can. Like, and she was like, her friend was like, what? What on earth? And it was just, it was embarrassing, you know? But I was so determined. You got to remember, as a kid, I was always told, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. And as someone with ADHD will tell you, and someone that's like an addict, like, I'm not taking no as an answer. And I think that the three of us, we are all very similar, the three boys, you know, the three of us who did this. Like, we are all rebels in our own right. We all suffer from some form of ADHD, addiction, mental health, all neurodivergent in some respect.
Is there, just before you go on there, because a lot of organisations now, big, iconic organisations who are hiring people across diversity, across age groups, are starting to understand that neurodiversity could also be a superpower within the organization.
Well, there you go. It is my superpower.
And let me just, for everyone watching and listening, let me give people a snapshot. You've talked very strongly, passionately about your life as an addict and then being the crazy person with your co-founders in 2015 to decide to be the first people to put water in a can. And then, let's be honest, I think there's something. David Attenborough saved your entire business, didn't he?
Yeah.
Was this 2019?
This was end of 2018.
Yeah. Go on. Tell us that story.
We were basically going bankrupt, and no one believed in us. We were calling up. You know, at this point, I was a fully fledged salesperson. Yep. We were calling up hundreds of people, and everyone just thought we were mental.
You're going up against some of the biggest brands in the world.
And no one was doing cans. Everyone thought cans was a stupid idea. And we were just calling up people and everyone was just like, there's no way this is going to be a thing, guys. We sat down with the founder of one of the biggest drinks companies in the whole country, owned by Coca-Cola. They just completely shut us down. There's no way that you're going to, you know, that you're going to get there, blah, blah, blah. There's no market for cans. And David Attenborough did Blue Planet, and we had gone from selling maybe 200,000 cans in like 2.5 years to literally selling nearly 10 to 12 million cans in 2019.
Right.
Because
where are we now?
What is
in? It's in selling.
Probably about
15 million
a year. Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But go on, David Attenborough.
No, David Attenborough did Blue Planet, and like, listen, but the truth is that we were planting a seed. But it needed David Attenborough, and like Sky had done this thing called Sky Ocean Rescue. And within literally 6 months, like we had fast forwarded about 10 years of what a lot of other brands.
Consciousness of the consumer.
Well, everyone was going on the same journey as us. Everyone it's sort of like out of sight, out of mind. Mental health's a bit like that, you know, out of sight, out of mind, can't see it, you know, don't worry about it. And people couldn't see plastic pollution. But as soon as people started seeing turtles with plastic in their noses and whales dying, and David Attenborough was talking about it. He's got a lovely little soft voice, doesn't he, David Attenborough? And they didn't hear it from these three lunatics. They heard it from David himself. They went on the same journey. And the journey...
Does he know he did this for
you? He does know it.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, I was speaking about this morning. Yeah, we told him. Yeah. We did tell him. We were very fortunate to be the water at an event at the Houses of Commons years ago, and we told him. And honestly, we... you know, everyone went on the same journey. The journey that we had gone on of seeing what was the best packaging. And people were like, oh, maybe these guys that have been calling us, these little kids that have been calling us for the past 2 years, maybe they're onto something. And, you know,
we started to catch on, didn't it?
People started to catch on. We started to get like Ellie Goulding was a fan of Can of Water, David Gandhi, Tiny Temper. And people started to talk about
Ricky Gervais, someone
Ricky said. Gervais now is an investor.
Is he?
He's an investor now, you know. And
Virgin Atlantic.
We're on Virgin Atlantic. Yeah,
so one of our just customers. Help us understand now this little crazy idea of you being the people who put water in a can is stocked. Just give us some examples of where we can now, apart from in the studio, obviously.
So honestly, it's so vast now that we are, you know, we've sold nearly 70 million cans. We are stocked up and down the country in all different places. You know, people will see us in theatres, hotels,
Selfridges,
restaurants. You know, we are in, you know, selected Tesco. You know, we're in a lot of big independent coffee shops, and we supply the BBC and Sky, and we're on some massive movie sets. And, you know, we've built a phenomenal business and a great brand. I'm going to be completely, you know, it's not easy. It's
nothing's
it's,
been
it's
easy,
only,
has it, Josh?
It only gets harder, in all honesty. Yeah. I think that, you know, me as an individual has grown from something that if I was going to write a book, and I've said this to quite a lot, if I was going to write a book, it would be called, when I write a book, it would be called The Accidental Entrepreneur. I never knew, I couldn't be the person I am now without all of the stuff that we've covered, you know, on this podcast. And I think that what I've learned, especially from being told no so many times, is you need some real strong resilience, and you need to basically just keep going. And it is never going to be easy. There are so many highs. There are so many lows, because, you know, we've won things. We lose things. You know, the plastic problem is still huge. We've got canned water competitors coming in left, right and centre who still sell hundreds of millions of plastic bottles.
We've just had Liquid Death pull out.
There you go.
Haven't we?
Liquid Death have pulled out. Well,
what's your take on that?
Listen, I think Liquid Death are a great brand, and we need Liquid Death to win because they've got so much money and they're building the category. But at the same time, we are English, okay? We are very skeptical people.
Yeah.
We don't buy into things very easily. In the US, they buy into things a lot quicker, and they find different things funny and quirky that we don't, okay? We look at something and we're just like, yeah, we don't buy into that. We don't necessarily buy into celebrity hype as well, whereas there they really, really do buy into a lot of that.
You have to do this organically through just sheer hard work and bloody mindedness.
Well, we have to, because they've raised hundreds of millions. You know, we've raised in our entirety what they spent on a 7-second Super Bowl ad.
Right.
So that's the difference. And that, you know, that is also sad. That should tell you as well what the UK landscape's like versus the US. In the US, there's so much more opportunity. In this country, I can't tell you the amount of times that people have turned around and said, there is no way that I'm investing in this business. I don't believe in it. But there's a company in America, Liquid Death, who have raised hundreds of millions. And that is, you know, that is the reality of this country. And, you know, the death of small brands and the death of risk takers in this country is the economy and the landscape.
What's the hope for Can of Water then at the moment? I mean, you're selling 15 million cans a year, and here we are. What's the plan then?
The plan is to grow. You know, we are launching in the US, in California. You need a lot of money to do it. We're kind of there now, but we're very, very sort of slowly looking at what that's going to look like. And, you know, some things that are very important for us is looking at new products. So whether that be in different flavors, which is something that we're looking at, as well as different forms of aluminium packaging. You know, everything's aluminium to us. Everything's like aluminium's the number one. We are Can of Water at the end of the day. And, you know, just build a great team, which we've got. And, you know, for me to be, you know, the best leader and the best sort, because I am not a conventional CEO. I mean, what even is a CEO? It could be anything. You know, I haven't got a background. I've never done it before. I'm winging it every single day, honestly. You know, I am definitely a bit, you know, I sometimes I have to, from an ADHD perspective, I find it incredibly hard to stay focused. Sometimes I have to just take my shoes off and sort of lay on the couch, just look at and just look up at the ceiling and listen to some music and get back in. You know, we talk about stimulant. Mm. Like, I need stimulants. I have to go on a walk. I have to have an ice bath.
Positive stimulants.
Exactly. And that's my superpower today. That is it.
You're older and wiser, Josh.
Exactly.
As well, right?
I've worked out.
With a family.
That, exactly. I've worked out what are the things that make me be the best version of me. Okay. I always say that to my wife. Like, you've got the best version of Josh White. Okay. I could never have been that person. My daughter, okay, has the best version of me.
10 months
okay?
old, right?
10 months old.
Amazing.
Just the greatest gift of all time. And
well, that will change everything.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I never in a million years thought that I would be where I am now. And don't get me wrong, there are days where things, it's like the iceberg, the top of the iceberg. Sure. Everyone sees this can
well,
everywhere.
That's like mental health.
Underneath the iceberg, I'm battling with my mind and things every single day. Okay. But I have to, and it's difficult to do this when you're an addict and I've got ADHD, I have to take a step back one day and just look at what I've accomplished.
Mm.
You know, like where I was then to where I am now, and just look at that journey. And so I get emotional about it because that person never in a million years thought that they could be where they are now. And, you know, I speak at a lot of schools and... I try and get that into a kid's head. You don't need to know. You don't have to have all the answers at 17 years old.
I'm still trying to work stuff out.
We all are. Every day is a different day. Stop trying to sort of, you know, stop trying to have it all figured out. All you need to do is just find you. And when you've found you, and that's one thing that I'm really proud of myself about. I love music. I'm a DJ, still DJ. And I love having purpose. And I'm doing that with Can of Water. And that's now I know what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Let me ask you this question, Josh. Do you feel you've got to a place where you actually now can love yourself?
I definitely love myself. I would say that I have days where I'm fearful for my future. I'm still running a risky business.
You're still the human being.
But... I can sit with myself now without like when I was a kid, I had to be with people because I couldn't be by myself. My wife's gone away. Yeah. She's away now for two weeks. I'm going to meet her. I couldn't go with her. I'm quite busy at the moment. I've got to sit with myself every single night. Okay. And I'm good. It's taken me a long time to get to that, but I'm there.
I hope that this episode has been raw and very real. And as I say to you, I love the fact that we can courageously, and you've been incredibly courageous to explore that human being over the human doing. I've known you for a number of years and it's been amazing to track the trajectory. And I can only hope that there are leaders of any ages in all kinds of regions and in all kinds of sectors who will say to themselves, there's something in here for me in relation to me as a human being, how I'm dealing with self or how I'm dealing with those that I love, and I can't fix certain things, but
for sure.
Least I can understand and leverage others. And as I say, I'm forever indebted to you for the incredible words of wisdom and support you provided someone very close to me. And so this is a real issue. We're talking about real issues, mental health, neurodiversity,
100%.
And sometimes just trying to understand and love yourself before you can actually go on.
Yeah, just trying to get through the day.
Right. But also, this is an incredibly strong story of someone, as you say, who's gone from an addict where you nearly lost your life.
Yeah.
To now you are a co-founder and CEO of a multi-million dollar company. Should we say pounds? Sorry, I went all American there, didn't I? And you're about to do all kinds of exciting things with all kinds of exciting people. That's got to be a success story, Josh. What do you reckon?
Listen, I can't complain. I am, as I said, I didn't think I'd ever get here. So, whatever my future holds, I'm incredibly proud of, the person that I've become. And, I wouldn't be the person I am without, going through what I've gone through and the people that I've met, on my journey.
And here we are, Can of Water, the studio of the Leadership Enigma. It's all good, right?
It's all good.
Listen, Josh, I just want to say thanks so much for taking the time to come on
and
have this conversation. I really appreciate it.
All good. Thank you.
Thanks so very much. Cheers. Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.